gentlemen, boys and girls, Dying Time is here. That's right, we are talking about the 2017 version of It on a special edition of Kill by Kill. Well, greetings and salutations, Internet. It's your old pal Patrick Hamilton coming to you once again from Derry, Maine, or as close to it as we can possibly get. This is the Kill by Kill podcast, and usually we are dedicated to celebrating the least discussed component of any horror film, the characters, but we are breaking our formula this week because, let's face it, horror is having a moment, and at a moment that it well deserves. And so we're going to talk about the 2017 version of Stephen King's It, directed by Andy Muschietti. It's like it's a blockbuster fucking movie, so we had to talk about it. And there's one person that I trust if I'm going to get into the sewers and chase that clown spider. It's the one and only Gina Radcliffe. How are you doing, Gina?
I'm a little shook, as the kids say. I literally got back about an hour ago from seeing it.
So you are very fresh. You've had almost no time to process what you have seen.
Not really, no. I mean, I took my daughter to go see it, and we had that after movie chat where I proceeded to, you know, usefully explain everything that had been changed from the book to much to her, you know, edge of her seat attention, I'm sure.
Because everyone loves to be that person who explains the differences between the media types that a story has been told in.
I live for that. That's one of my reasons for being.
And it's why you're so good at it. But the good news is, Gina, we are not alone. Our good friend here, this is a three-peat. The one and only Phil Gonzalez is here. How are you doing, sir?
Oh, it's so great to be here to talk about this movie.
I immediately, when I started to read people's reactions to it online, and I saw some things that were coming in, I'm like, oh, I should grab Phil. If he's not going to talk about it on It's Del Toro Time,
I should
grab him to talk about it here.
Yeah, I almost did talk about it on Del Toro Time. It was in our head, but there was just no way for the two of us to see the movie in enough time to really get a firm grip on it at this date. We'll probably cover it later because we've covered Andres Muschietti's other movie, Mama. Mm-hmm. So I was really eager to see this one.
Oh, good. All right. So usually we would, you know, give you the rigmarole of a given movie, but let's face it. A good portion of our audience may have already seen it. If you haven't, it's a pretty simple story about a town that's full of evil that is personified on occasion by a crazy clown creature called Pennywise the Dancing Clown. And the seven kids who happen upon this secret in one way or the other and combine forces to try and stop it. Written by Stephen King. The novel was released, and I want to say 1986.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's about right.
Because that was a very distinct summer for me. That would be the summer I saw Aliens and The Fly on a constant basis. Mm. And when I wasn't watching those movies in the movie theater, mind you, I was reading this book. Mm-hmm. What was your previous experience with It? Did you read the book before the miniseries came out?
Oh, yeah, yeah. As I've mentioned before, I think in the first episode, I had one of those weird 70s and 80s upbringings where my parents basically put no limitations on what I could watch or read. Mm-hmm. So I read a lot of Stephen King. And, you know, I didn't understand a lot of Stephen King at the time that it took me probably a third read of The Shining when I was almost an adult to realize, oh, this is an allegory for alcoholism. Okay, I get it now. Right. And it made it so much of a better book. And I think that I got it out of the library pretty much as soon as it was released. And I spent the summer reading it. It blew my mind. I don't think I slept well that particular summer. I spent a lot of time fretting over how would this thing appear to me, because I had many things that I was afraid of. I was a fretful child. Mm-hmm. I was a fretful teenager. The only question was, how would he show up and appear to me before ripping my head off like poor Eddie Corcoran?
Very, very true. Phil, what was your
previous experience with the Stephen King generation of the story?
Well, I very much remember the year it came out because it was featured prominently on end caps at the grocery store when it was in paperback. And that's it's had that iconic cover of the green claw coming up through the grate, the sewer grate. But I didn't read it until the miniseries had been announced. And I wanted to read the novel before I saw the movie. So that would have been... It would have been my freshman year in high school, and I just devoured it. I read that thing. I mean, everyone was reading it. It was a huge deal at school to be reading it, and because it was just this massive tome, and it really stuck with me. I've read it several times since then. It's one of my favorite. For all of its problems, it has a lot. To me, it has a lot of issues, structural issues, content issues. Now that I can recognize, it's still just it's a thrilling novel, and it's very heartfelt, and it really made a big impact on me.
Yeah, I would say it was my favorite book for a very, very long time. It still might be, despite its issues, and I think maybe because of those issues, that it's just there are things that are inherently not okay with it, but make some sense in a metaphorical sense, even if when you look at it in plain of day, you're like, oh, that's wrong. I still believe there's a lot inherently in that book that describes a lot about what is wrong and what might be right about this country. In particular, it's a very American story.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So now we move on to the 1990 miniseries, which I watched with rapt attention. I videotaped it because I was the only person in the family who knew how to operate the VCR.
And weren't we all really?
Watched it rather obsessively. I owned a DVD copy of it. I watched it again a couple years ago, and I was amazed at how languid and misty it all is. And Tommy Lee Wallace directed it, who also directed Halloween 3 and quite a few things, but was very much a John Carpenter devotee and protege. And it doesn't really feel too much like a Tommy Lee Wallace picture either. And I think that has to do with it being on ABC television in 1990.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's very much... And I'd mentioned this elsewhere online. Something that is interesting about 70s to 90s TV horror is it's extremely limited in how much they can show and what their special effects budget is. And I feel that this movie really reflects it. I mean, the book itself is so gory and so over the top. I mean, I hate to go back to Eddie Corcoran's death, but this is a kid who gets his head ripped off. And I remember reading that and just like cringing, because I think this might have been the first time I'd ever read anything in which a child character had died violently. And it was just one after another, that kids getting their arms ripped off, kids getting torn apart, kids getting their faces ripped off. And it was relentless, and everything that is in the movie, the TV movie, is very much as typical, shown off screen, alluded to, hinted at, and it really loses that impact.
Yeah, I think the only thing that approached it for me was the jaunt.
I was just going to bring up the jaunt.
I mean, the jaunt still scares the hell out of me. The very idea of it. I don't want to give it away, because if you have not read it. Because
it's a one joke story.
I mean, it's like what? 12, 20 pages
best? It is longer than you remember, because it goes into the history of the jaunt.
Okay.
Remember, most of it. But Muschietti was attached to direct a movie of it.
How can you expand it to a movie?
That was it was optioned, and he was originally attached to it. So this isn't his first Stephen King rodeo as far as like helping develop a film goes. But that's one of my favorite bad, awesome Stephen King short stories.
Well, I mean, the kicker on it is his best kicker. I honestly believe that, and I'm sure there's someone who's going to say I'm wrong, and you can believe that, but in my book it's his best kicker. But that's where I felt like, oh, at the point I was reading him, like, no one is safe the way he writes this stuff, and it only proves that point. And then when you ABC bought it before it even was published. So they wanted this. They saw an opportunity. They're like, hey, this could be a mini series for us. This could be hot. And then they must have started reading through almost 1,200 pages worth of stuff and go, oh, I was under a very different impression as to what this might be. This child-killing clown. How are we going to do this on primetime television? For just, I don't know, did they do it over 3 hours
just
each night or 2 hours?
Two hours each night. Yeah. But with commercials,
Oh my God. So about 3 hours total.
Yeah.
And we don't need to denigrate it any more than you can swing a dead cat and hit somebody denigrating it online right now. Let's suffice to say that at the time it worked, and it primarily worked for one reason. And that is the actor who is playing Pennywise owns every second. He is on screen. It is insane how good he is as Pennywise the Clown.
Can I make a controversial statement, though?
Sure. No.
I think the Pennywise in the new version was actually a little more effective.
I would agree with you. The what it brings over works for this infinitely better. And I, you know, for the ABC version, like, his performance was all you had to go on as far as delivering, you know, real spook 'em up scares, because, you know, a guy in werewolf hands isn't exactly, you know, breaking the bank on the spooky meter.
Well, I think that it is one of those difficult adaptations, because, and I know I've discussed this with a lot of friends about Stephen King, is Stephen King is really good in his novels at presenting an absurd situation that reads stupid, but that he's able to say, no, this is actually terrifying if you're there. If this is actually happening to you, if a movie Wolfman were really coming at you, that would be scary. It's not scary to see it happen because it looks as ridiculous as it sounds. But he's able to put you in the mind of the person in that situation. So when you're reading it, you're like, oh, this actually is terrifying. Unfortunately, when you try to translate a lot of what Stephen King describes to the visual medium, it loses all of its punch, because you have this remove and you're like, no, that's just a wolfman. That's not scary at all, because you're not inside the characters' heads anymore. Yeah. And I think because the miniseries is so flat, there's no style to it. There's no atmosphere. When you just sort of show these things, I mean, even the modern filmmakers were like, no, we can't do that, because that's just, it just doesn't work in a film.
Yeah. I would absolutely agree with that. It's my, what works on the side of a van doesn't necessarily work when you see it in motion. The only time I feel like it's ever come close is Conan the Barbarian. And every other time someone goes, oh, look how cool that is on the side of that van. Wouldn't it be cool if that were a movie? And you come out with fucking Ghost Rider and you're like, oh, that fucking doesn't work. Not at all. I feel like, you know, Tim Curry works for what that is. And it worked for its time.
Well, and I'll say that I think Tim Curry actually worked – he worked better for me in the first scene with Georgie, because I didn't believe for a split second that a kid would hear the voice coming out of Bill Skarsgård's mouth and not just run screaming that second, because – Tim Curry presented the clown very matter of fact. He's like, hello, how are you doing? I'm a clown. Whereas as soon as Skarsgård hits the screen, he's like, hello, how are you? And I'm like, no, that's There's no seduction there. There's no trickery. It's like, oh, here's an evil monster. And that was the one moment where I was like, ooh, dial it back a little bit. Like, we get that you're the bad guy. Just dial it back a little bit.
I sort of feel like, though, he looks sort of initially ridiculous. Like, he's got, like, these, like, weird Bugs Bunny teeth originally. And I think that, you know, a small child would be kind of confused. Well, he sounds kind of scary, but he looks kind of funny. So, you know, maybe he's all right.
And the one thing
I mean, let's face it, children are dumb. So, you know, I mean,
they can, and he had just hit his head.
Yeah, he did. He was probably, he was a little confused. You know, he was like 6 years old. So, you know, I could see where, you know, a 6 year old might at least be a little, you know, he might be okay.
Yeah, he not only has the bunny teeth, but, and this is something that persists throughout the entire movie, his eyes go in slightly different directions.
That freaked me the hell out.
Which starts off ridiculous, and then when you start to get the reason why they're going in different directions, you're like, oh, that's crazy creepy.
Oh, no, that got me. That I noticed that almost immediately, and that freaked me out. Also, that he was drooling a lot. Which just like, I mean, he's like staring at Jordy and like just drool is starting to, and it's like, oh, that's my, like, the hairs on my arm started standing up. It's just, I mean, it very much playing into a kind of monstrous, almost like a pedophile sort of thing. And it's like, there was a lot of nice little touches in this.
That could have just been the makeup. It could have just been poor Bill Skarsgård unable to.
Yeah, it could have been just he can't.
Unable to talk around that prosthetic lip.
Or can't close his mouth around the teeth or something. So
he's like, he just keeps drooling. You know what? Just keep it. Keep it.
I like it. It looks good.
Mm-hmm. Also, his eyes do kind of go off in two different directions, so we'll just play that up. Yeah.
And they change color, which is also, you know.
And he's killed a lot of kids. We'll work that into the story.
Man, he is Jared Leto just wishes he was as much of a method actor.
Oh, yeah. Leto.
They probably had to physically restrain Jared Leto from busting onto the set every, like, few days.
I have ideas. I have murdered 10 children. You're going to give me this fucking part.
So let's at this point tell the audience, those who have not happened to seen it yet, you may want to pause the podcast, and you have the ability to do that. It's not gonna go anywhere. You've already downloaded it, or it will know where you stopped. Go see the movie and come back, because now we're gonna spoil the hell out of everything that happens in it. Just know, we, for the most part, can we say we liked the movie?
I thought it was great, yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was really good.
I really, really enjoyed it. So, if you just want to know the opinions, this is the build-up. Our opinions are, we are very, very positive about it. And now, let's get into the meat of it. Let's start with Georgie getting his arm fully ripped off.
It was bitten off.
Yeah.
While a woman says, I don't want to pay attention to what's happening over there.
Well, that's a thing in the book. One thing I want to say very complimentary towards it. Now, Patrick, you grew up in Los Angeles, and Phil, I think you grew up in Houston. Do I have that right?
Yeah, just north of Houston, yeah.
Okay, so neither of you really had that small town experience.
No.
I did. I initially lived in a town that had less than 5,000 people, and then eventually moved to a town that had less than 2,000 people in it. So one thing that King does really well, and one thing this movie does well, is just that whole, what I call the everybody knows everybody shit kind of vibe, where like once you have a bad reputation, it follows you around wherever you go. The everything that people think is sort of, you know, desirable about a small town, I kind of hate. Like, everything's very isolated, everybody knows each other, you know, everybody's just sort of, it's always an unnerving setting. But one thing, a repeated theme in the book, was the adults just did not want jack fucking shit to do what was happening to the kids. I mean, there's a scene in a very memorable scene in the book, which event was not used in the movie, was when Eddie gets his arm broken by Henry Bowers. There is pointed out that, like, somebody said, hey, what are you kids doing? And then when, like, Henry vaguely looks in their direction, they run away. And that's something that happens a lot, where the parents, the adults in the town, they're either ineffectual or they're predators themselves. You've got Beverly's father, which they do bring that into the movie. You've got the creepy pharmacist. You've got Eddie's mother, who I'm glad that they toned that down slightly for the movie, because in the book she really kind of comes off as an almost grotesque stereotype.
A Stephen King character?
Yeah, like just a very, you know, and I am curious as to when they do the second half of the movie, if ultimately you're going to find out that Eddie basically married his mother and that Beverly and that Beverly basically married her father. And I'm wondering.
I'm really hoping they don't.
You're hoping
I would like them to change those elements of it to something that we have not seen before. It is the most expected thing in the world.
I think that makes it sort of sad that, you know, they all escape from these towns, but they still have some part of themselves sort of linked back to Derry. You know,
I think that's what he was trying to get at, is that they never actually left the town.
Right. And they just keep repeating the same patterns over and over again. Like, you know, Ben loses a lot of weight, but he still thinks of himself as the fat kid, which is very accurate. Can I just say, I am really, really excited that they cast an actual fat kid to play a fat kid.
Yeah, they really did.
I am delighted that this was not, you know, he was not some, you know, vaguely chubby, soon to be, you know, thin and fit teenage boy. No, they cast an actual fat kid, and he was fucking great.
Now, the kid who played Ben in the miniseries was what we were calling, he was definitely 1950s fat.
Yeah, he was husky.
Yeah, husky. But if you had seen him on a TV show in 1950, that still would have been the fat kid. Like, I think we have a different idea in 1988 versus 1958 of what a large kid would be.
Yeah, he looked like he would be like the Ben of the TV series, like somebody you see working on a farm.
The real problem with the Ben of the TV series is he looks like he could take some of the greaser bullies.
Boys, yeah.
He does. Was
he's like a future linebacker.
He had a tough face.
Yeah. And he doesn't project a level of helplessness that the Ben Haystack in this does. He doesn't feel intimidating at any point. He just wants to go along to get along.
Yeah.
And I think they did a very good job in casting all these kids.
They did.
A lot to be said about almost all of these kids that are fantastic.
I will say that initially when Beverly appeared on screen, I'm like, this girl, so she's like 17. And I'm like, oh, right. But in the book, she's supposed to already look kind of womanly and have a lot of you know, weird interactions with men and older boys because of that. So the more it went on, I was like, yeah, I'm buying this now. Okay, this is good.
I think, unfortunately, almost all of us might have had an experience with the one or five girls in our class who happened to blossom, if I'm going to use an old-fashioned term, before all the boys, which are constantly lagging behind both physically, mentally, and emotionally.
Yeah, because she was, I mean, the actor herself is only, she was like 14 when the movie was being filmed. 14 or 15, young 15. So, yeah, I mean, they cast someone age appropriate. But I think it is one of those situations where once you learn more about her character, the way she carries herself, the way she presents herself at school makes a lot more sense.
Well, she's had to grow up faster than all of those other kids.
Yeah.
And that is one of the things that defines Beverly by hook or by crook, that she is ahead of these boys in a lot of different ways. She has to be more worldly. She has to be more aware of her surroundings. They can be more blissfully innocent because of our delightful patriarchal society. Anyways, so that then gets me to one thing I was sort of alluding to when Georgie gets his arm bitten off. The thing that I really like about this movie is that it projects a town in which everyone is allowed to move ahead so long as they don't care about what gets the sausage made. So long as evil is allowed to exist underground, and so long as they turn towards it at some point, they get to churn forward, and that's all they care about. This feeling that pervades Derry is, I think, very timely for where we are, which is if we don't expose things that are underground our society and we do not flush the systems of this stuff, we're just letting it eat future generations underneath us, and we're sacrificing them so that we can live this other life on top of it. And I was struck again, having not read the book in 5 years, that theme yet again just felt like very fresh to me.
Oh yeah, and again, you know, if you're still listening, you haven't watched it, turn it off because it's a spoiler. Mm-hmm. When Pennywise is about to, when he basically offers the other members of the Losers Club, well, you can just leave Bill with me. You know, you can escape just like you wanted to. You can live your, you know, you can live to a ripe old age. And you know, what do you say? You can just go back to the weeds or something like that, which is, you know, basically I'll give you, you know, you can die of old age. And that, yeah, it's just like, if you turn your back on this, you'll be able to live a normal life. And yeah, that's, you know, that's very, that's like, you're like, then you're like, oh shit. You know, it's right. Like, and they all looked like, you know, they were thinking about it for a second. Certainly poor Stan was, you know, I mean, you know, knowing what happens to that character, I felt for Stan. I really did. I think Stan was the audience surrogate, the one who really wants to be brave, but knows that, you know, he's going to be pissing and crying and not being able to come through when, you know, the time comes.
Oh my God, when he puts his bike into a kickstand every time,
yes.
And everyone else lays their bikes down, I'm like, whoever thought of this gag? It's so fucking perfect for that character.
Yeah, they all gave them such, you know, diverse personalities. I mean, you know, Richie was, you know, funny to the point of being irritating, like, you know, a lot of class clowns are, but of course he had the best lines in the movie. You know, Mike was very stoic, very, you know, he was probably second to Beverly and basically being an adult in a child's body. Eddie, you know, tried, but was a little bit of a wimp. And of course, you know, Bill was the, you know, unspoken of leader of the group. And they did a lot to make them, to differentiate them from each other, which is hard when you're dealing with, you know, seven different characters all, you know, jockeying for, you know, position in front of the camera.
I was going to say, I thought they did a good job of really maintaining the humor between all the kids without it becoming a lot of forced jokes, like it kind of happens in the miniseries. Muschietti, I mean, just from his experience with Mama, you know that he's really good at working with children, at getting great, very natural performances out of them. Mm-hmm. And these kids had obviously been worked with, like directed to just in the direction of just having very, very believable interactions as children and as friends. Like, you could tell which friends had been together the longest and which of the kids weren't really as deep into the group, like in that, and that dynamic stayed consistent throughout the entire movie.
Yeah. And I feel like they built it, at least for me, they built the relationship within all seven of them to the point where that rock fight happens. It felt way more natural than it did in the miniseries.
Yeah.
And I swear to God, there must have been someone at Warner Brothers who said, I want that rock fight at minute 35. You know, there was someone pushing for it. Like, we got to get going. Let's throw some rocks. Let's have them be best friends. And you need to put them all in a corner where they don't feel they have anybody else. And when they discover that they do have somebody else, that there is someone who will stand with them, it is a revelation to them. And that bonds them in a way that if it just happened because the script told them to, it wouldn't be nearly as believable or cathartic or interesting.
Now, I do want to bring up springing off of the rock fight. Because, and this is to me one of those things that makes it seem very obvious that this is a script that went through many different hands, went through many permutations, was edited and re-edited and brought back to people and turned into something else. And we know that it did just from looking at like the different drafts. But because of the way they rewrote some of the story from the book. So you don't meet, they don't get together with Mike until well into the movie. But they also took away part of Mike's character, well, most of Mike's character from the book, which was Mike being the sort of town, the historian among all the kids, the kid who's very interested in the history of Derry. They took that entire plot and gave it to Ben because they took away Ben being an architect. Like, they didn't have the kids building a dam. They didn't have the kids building any kind of, like, clubhouse or anything. So Ben wasn't able to be an architect, so they had to make him be something in the group. So they gave him the archivist and the historian role, which meant that Mike ends up getting left with nothing to do for a huge chunk of the movie. He disappears. Like, where normally we would be seeing him investigating the history of the town, you're introduced to him, you get to see him have a run-in with the bullies, and then until he's brought into the group, he just completely disappears. And I feel that that was a real disservice to the character, because whereas all the other kids kind of got their thing, I feel like Mike was just given a bolt gun, which he then lost, like, halfway through the movie.
Yeah, and again, in thinking about how they're going to treat the second half, I mean, Mike was the only one that stayed behind in the town. And I'm wondering, does this seem like something this character would do as far as the movie? I mean, he doesn't like it there, and he doesn't, I can't imagine how they would explain away that he feels some sort of obligation to stay in town, which he does at the end of the book too. Despite after the second go around, he still elects to stay behind, and I think with this, the way he's written in the movie, I don't imagine that that's how he's going to be written in the second part, because it wouldn't really make any sense with the character arc.
Right, and they in the book makes it very clear that, like, you know, Ben was good at building things. He becomes an architect. Bill was very imaginative. He becomes a writer. And then Mike was very interested in history and archives, and he becomes a librarian. And like going off what you just said, I'm curious, like, what are they going, because they don't introduce a lot of those character traits. I'm wondering if part two is just going to be very different than what we get in the book.
It's entirely possible. They do sort of set up something, which I wish they had fleshed out in one scene, which is, if you take some of the actual history stuff and put it on Ben, and Mike is the person who comes in with the information that my family, and he's talking about his grandfather there, which in the book alludes to his grandfather being related to the caretaker at the Overlook Hotel.
They weren't related. They were army buddies.
They were army buddies. Right. So he has the sort of dirty version, the skinny of how the town actually works. And I wish they had fleshed out, well, this is what the history books, and he goes, well, what I found out what really happened was this. And they have a meeting of the minds where they're like, oh, we're both interested in this, and we can come at it from two different directions. Right. If they had just had one thing of that, I think it would have gone a long way towards making that swap more palatable. And they just, maybe they had it, maybe they didn't, or maybe they felt that garage scene was too full of information already that they didn't want to overload it, which I get. But again, he has to be a part of that group and equal in every single way. And I feel like they're trying to do that with how he deals with Bowers, but I don't know. I don't know if it's as successful for everyone as
I'm just a little curious as to which one of them is going to have the honors of calling the rest of them to come back, because you can't. It's unclear from the way they ended the. We know that Beverly is leaving. And if they're if they're following the book, all of them except Mike eventually leave.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering which one of them is going to have that particular task to do, which of course results in one of the characters. Let's just say they don't show up.
Right.
But we're into spoiler territory.
Well, one of the hard things about the movie, and I don't want to feel like I'm ragging on it, but it's one of the weaknesses of the miniseries as well, which is the book, of course, is structured like it jumps back and forth between modern time and the past, and it also has these interludes of Derry history. So the story is very spread out. Like, you don't find out what happens at the end of the kid's story until you get to the end of the adult story, because they're happening simultaneously. But because of the way it's structured, by dividing these two stories into two separate movies, all the tension, you know, these kids are going to survive. Like, there's no, they could get hurt, but because you know they're coming back, all coming back in the second movie, there was never any doubt in my mind that they were going to make it through their experiences. And I know that that's just the, that's one of the issues with like any adaptation, but something very, it was something just, I noticed a lot in this where I was just like, well, I'm not really worried about their safety because there's going to be an It too, and it's going to have all these characters in it. Whereas when you're reading it sort of going side by side, the whole thing is just very seat of your pants. I don't know. There was just something, there was a loss of tension for me in the way the story is structured in this way.
I can understand that. I also feel like if you had tried to mix it up, it would not have felt complete in any way, shape, or form. I don't know that you can make a movie that's structured the way the miniseries book is. I just can't imagine it. If you go through and you have the sort of hook that the miniseries has, we told people that it's spoilers at this point.
Yeah.
It's this, okay. Or like I said offline, cutting each other off with like an air horn sound effect. You're like, stop, you're going into spoiler territory. We'll bring it back.
You're going into you have to know the story spoiler territory. They set up a very good reason why Eurus doesn't come back. And he has the closest encounter with it. And in the miniseries, how they really get you is they introduce all these characters sort of in order. And you finally get to Eurus, Stan Eurus's, and we cut back to him. And he has gone upstairs, taken a bath, cut open his wrists, and written it in blood on the white tile.
Yeah.
He cannot fathom going back to Derry. He's too traumatized by what has happened to him. And it grabbed me the first time I saw the miniseries, and it grabs you in the book. And this gives you a very good reason as to why that's going to work in the second movie. But if you structured it the same way, I'd be like, it would be very episodic. My guess.
Yeah.
Which is fine for television because it's broken up into little segments because of commercials. But in a movie, I just don't know how it would work. It would break my brain.
Well, I feel like he's, you know, at all times I hate to use the weak link in the group because he does come through. But even at the very end, you could tell he's wavering and he's the first one to leave. And I don't think that he was entirely joking when he told Bill, I hate you. You know, I think he kind of laughs like, haha, yeah, funny joke. But no, I think he meant it. And I feel that I don't recall if the book went into this too much, but I feel like it might have been like a Stand By Me sort of thing where you found out that they kind of just drifted apart for a while because none of them really remembers the experience. And then I think
they drift apart immediately in the book. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, some 27 odd years later, you know, just, you really want to be you reminded of this, you know, horrific trauma from your childhood just out of nowhere. And I'd be very surprised if the second half does not follow through on what happens to him in the book, because I feel like it's setting him up to be continuously be the one who really can't handle it.
Yeah. And I do wonder how they're going to, in the book, Henry Bowers ends up being blamed for the deaths, and that he's the patsy. Yeah. He's also stared straight into the deadlights and his brain is fried. And so 27 years later, Pennywise comes to knocking and says, all the people who set you up in this are coming back to town. Why don't you kill them for me? And so you get the reprise of the greaser bully comes back. So there's, I don't know how they're going to accomplish that necessarily. I like your idea, Phil, that the second half of this does not have to be a replication of either the miniseries or the book.
Yeah.
It could just be what works.
Well,
second half.
One thing I have my fingers crossed for, and I doubt it'll happen, but So this movie very much reflects modern trends in horror. It very much reflects kind of the Blumhouse school of horror, which is the which you sort of notice in like the Insidious movies, in the Ouija movies. This let's focus on what's the movie about the haunted house?
The Conjuring.
The Conjuring. That's what I'm thinking of. The Conjuring. This let's explore horror in the past. Let's make it very, very domestic focused. Let's have a lot of like creepy sounds and a lot of like more atmosphere than scares a lot of the time. But because it's very modern horror, the new resurgence of modern horror is very domestic focused and very family focused and very character driven. As wonderful as that is, I'm hoping that they bravely in the second movie go into what I consider one of my favorite aspects of it and the part that most people rarely talk about, which is the fact that while it starts as very domestic Stephen King horror, it suddenly expands into grand Lovecraftian cosmic horror. About ancient gods and ancient creatures, and like this is a entity that has existed on Earth since the time of the dinosaurs, and it has poisoned the ground, and there are rituals and seemingly like this terrifying magic that's running through threads in this story, and there's the turtle, and there's like it itself, and then there's the creatures beyond the veil. And I would love it if the second movie just blew up and finally let the ritual of Chud become part of the storyline and finally explain the deadlights, because in the miniseries, it just becomes another battle with a spider and it's a real letdown. And I'm just wondering and hoping and praying that they finally just break down and say, we're just going to go full cosmic with this. We're going to take the horror out of the streets and up into like the other side of reality.
Well, I think that, you know, I would like to see that too. And I think that the way that they treated, what did you guys think of how Pennywise was apparently just storing these children away in like this sort of like lava lamp of dead children? Yeah, I thought it was a little strange. Like, I thought it was weird that as opposed to the book, where there was no mistake that these children have been brutally murdered, in the movie they all were just simply missing.
Well, when he shoots, no spoiler alert, but when he shoots Georgie in the head, when Georgie's like, my arm's missing and I want to come back home, and he's like, bang, in the middle of the forehead, and Georgie just falls to the ground initially, I was like, oh shit. Was that really just Georgie? Are we going to find out these kids are all just trapped in the sewers and like he hasn't killed anyone? And I was like, that'd be a real twist on the ending. I was like, sorry, Bill, that was actually Georgie that time. No, of course it wasn't. It was a hidden clown. But
they dragged that out pretty well, though. I was like, eh?
They did.
I was kind of like, oh shit. And then.
But I was like. I was kind of with you. I was like, are these kids going to all float down and have just been in a trance like Beverly this entire time? Or are they dead? Like, you never saw the bodies land, so I never, like, it cuts away before you see what happens with all these kid bodies.
I think that they are actually supposed to be dead, and he's just sort of feeding off of them. I mean, maybe at some point they were alive, but, you know, eventually they just... you died of shock or died of blood loss or whatever. I mean, I think it would be very not good if we found out, oh no, they're all okay. They rescued them out of the tunnels and everybody's a hero now. And I'm hoping they don't do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have to believe that a lot of that third act has some setup for some cosmic craziness.
I hope so. I hope so much.
It does actually give you the, like, oh, that's why everyone's talking about you float down there. It's not just a sewer thing that we've...
Or just a reference to balloons. That's what I always thought it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then it harkens back to the balloons. Why is he so into balloons? This is this mechanism that he's wrapped himself around this story for so long. That this is how he amuses himself.
Yeah.
And it's all this temple to this that anyone who might happen upon it would be so insanely freaked out by what they saw, they might drop dead in fright. And so that part of it worked for me. I am a little bit weary of the idea of a giant cosmic turtle.
Oh no, we gotta have the turtle. But look, they blew it. They blew it this year with the Dark Tower movie, which should have been the ultimate in cosmic horror. Like Stephen King's, here's the beginning of like, you're going to find out that you think Killer St. Bernard is scary? Well, wait until you find out that there are things beyond reality that are even more horrifying than you could possibly imagine. They threw that away. So to me, like, it is the last stand for seeing this weird universe that, because the turtle, of course, is a part of the Dark Tower universe. And you find out in the Dark Tower universe, of course, that the creature that is it, is a fairly weak and kind of a nothing entity in the cosmology of Stephen King's world. He's a kind of a joke. And
yeah, he's defeated with an asthma inhaler in one scene, if I recall. Yeah.
But like even like his like level of beings are not very well respected. They're not that strong. They're not like there's bigger and worse things than this thing out there. And even if they don't do a turtle, even if they don't do the giant turtle at the end of the world, I would just love to see them go into some kind of like let's just get weird in the second movie.
I agree. I think it's better now that now that this base has been built. There's no point in simply repeating it. What I do not want to do is have that, you know, six of them come back and then, you know, dance to the Okie Pokie. Like,
can we get a scene of them just riding around on a bicycle, though? Because that's the best part of the movie.
The far and away, just them laughing to soul music while they're eating Chinese food.
I don't know. I would like to see the Chinese food scene. I think that that's a pretty effective scene in the book. And I mean, of course, you know, in the miniseries, it was pretty cheesy looking, but I think it could be done, you know, better now. This is sort of, you know, you're having a good time. Oh, nope, here's an eyeball on your fortune cookie.
because the cosmic stuff, to me, the cosmic stuff balances out the whole, like, riding a bicycle to get your wife's mind back. It balances out all the like, very small personal demons. Because that's what an 1,100-page novel does. Like, it lets you go to the edges of space, but also like deal with the inner fears of these characters. And I think they have because this movie is doing so well. I think they have a good opportunity to like mess with the audience a little bit more.
I should hope that they take that opportunity to do it. And it's not like you could have an endless number of It movies. You got. One, you set this up for like 1, 2. There's no third punch. So you might as well really swing for the fences and do some crazy stuff. I don't know how it's going to go over, but as I've said many times on this podcast and others, I would much rather watch somebody get up to the plate and start swinging for the fences.
Yeah.
Then try to bunt their way to first base. There's just, it's not what I paid parking for and bought a hot dog and hauled my 7-year-old there for. Swing for the fences.
Oh, can I also say that I made a joke on one of my friends was talking about not wanting to see this movie because of how terrifying it looked. And I said, we were trying to give him an idea of what it was like because I'll personally say I didn't find the movie scary so much as spooky and very atmospheric. And I'm easily scared, but I will say that when he was like, what is it like? I said, okay, imagine Stranger Things. That's it.
and it's easy because the actor that plays Richie is also in Stranger Things.
But I'm going to say that this movie would not exist without Stranger Things. Oh, absolutely not. They captured lightning in a bottle with Stranger Things, and then they captured it again with this movie. Like, and it feels so much like Stranger Things was obviously inspired by the works of Stephen King, particularly by It. And now It is being very much inspired by the aesthetic of Stranger Things, like you said, down to having one of the cast members in it, because and I'm not saying that as a criticism. Like it's very user friendly. It feels like an old shoe. The scene where Stan is being chased by the leper. That's Stan,
Eddie,
right?
Eddie was the one who was
Eddie. Sorry. The scene where Eddie is being chased by the leper felt so much like an 80s horror film. I was like, ooh, this is a monster movie. Mm-hmm. Like, we haven't gotten a good visceral monster movie in a while. And there's some monsters in this. Like, and it was makeup and reaching out with hands and like chasing across the lawn. It was like something you would have seen in Demons or The Gate or something. Like, just a movie you would turn on in the middle of the night when you're 9 years old and like sit there and watch against all better judgment. Like there's elements of that feel, like a legitimate version of that feeling of for every like Super 8 that tries to capture the feel of old Spielberg movies. This one definitely had the grit and the whole like, you know what? Being a kid's kind of shitty.
Yes.
You know, you get treated like shit and people don't believe you and even your friends are jerks and you get hurt when you're playing with them. But at the end of the day, you just got to hug and make up and remember who's got your back. And that's that Steve, that's that E.T. thing. That's that Goonies thing. And this was like Goonies with a higher body count in a way. because you had these sort of just like grotesque kids. Like, they weren't perfect kids. They all had their flaws and they were all kind of asses. And you had these kids who had all been hurt by society, and damn it, they come together and they love each other and they do a good job. And like, that's something you just don't see a whole lot in movies.
What I like about it being informed by Stranger Things is, and there seems to be this weird backlash again, like, it's 80s nostalgia. I'm sick of 80s nostalgia. And I kind of like wince a little bit and I'm like, you don't think I had to put up with this shit about people romancing the 50s and the 60s while I grew up? You would have thought people walked on gold sidewalks with diamond shoes in the fucking 60s, the way it was. Everyone just, oh, the music, oh, the revolution. And you're like, shut up. And I don't feel that this is overly invested in nostalgia-ness.
Right.
I just don't want to get angry that someone has a fucking movie poster up in their bedroom.
What I love about,
I had movie posters up right in my fucking bedroom. It's not science fiction.
I feel like this movie does a good job at, because it has to be set in the 80s, if you want to set the second movie in modern time, this has to be a period piece.
Yeah.
They do a good job at grounding it in the 80s without just rolling around in it. This isn't The Wedding Singer. And it's not even Stranger Things. Like it does enough set dressing and enough establishing of the time period just to make you feel like you're back in that time. And there's enough jokes and enough little references, but they're all character based. All the New Kids on the Block stuff, which was amazing.
Yes, but that is all set up.
Yeah.
That Ben is new in town, and while that might have flown wherever he was from, it's like, what I really want is when we come back to Ben, he's still just like listening to pop music. It's just whatever happens to be in the pop hemisphere, he's still listening to it.
What if he's managing a boy band? He's one of those creepy boy band producers. Like, he's started like several successful bands.
He's the biggest boy band manager in the world. He's like that one guy in Orlando who built himself a mansion and then touched people.
Yes.
Oh,
they just make him an XP of that guy. And and it picks up right where he's like lost his empire. And so he has no reason to not go back to Derry. I think it would just be a nice reflection of how he's never let Beverly go and has instead like turned like his like youthful his youthful pining for Beverly into a youthful pining for boy band performers. Like, he's conflated the two impulses, the two urges. And now the only way he can like find satisfaction is through like the management of boy bands.
Yeah, like he can't get an erection unless he goes, oh, under his breath.
Wait, there's people who can?
Oh, we've blown the lid off it.
Self-zinging.
that was a great gag with the poster on the back of Benny's.
It works so well.
It does.
I was just cracking up in that scene.
But it's not just 80s posturing.
Yeah.
The point of it is not to go, the 80s were stupid. There's
or the 80s were awesome. This isn't Ready Player One.
No. Oh, God. Every time I see that fucking trailer.
Did you know the Iron Giant's in it?
The fuck that Freddy Krueger's in it and half of the horror Twitter was like, yay! I'm like, shut, guys.
You're all shills.
You're not. This is how it gets you. And just the copy on it. As a person who writes copy professionally, I have a problem with calling Steven Spielberg a cinematic game changer. Let's give that a couple more drafts, guys. One of my friends wrote that. I apologize, but I just it's not for me.
Yeah, I read a review that focused a lot on the fact that we obviously mentioned this, that the time setting has been changed for the children's half of the story from 1958 to 1988, and they said that they thought that was good because it was a movie that was meant to play into people who were that age when they first read the book when it first came out. Oh. So basically people like us.
Yes.
And that it would kind of, you know, hit you in that sort of visceral, you know, because obviously a lot of fans of horror were probably nerdy kids who were, you know, had their books knocked out of their arms by people like Henry Bowers when they were in school. And it just, you know, plays on all those different sort of mixed, not always entirely positive emotions.
Now, we've talked about some very good reviews. A lot of people have been very positive towards it. There's also been a prevailing attitude amongst some reviews that's a little too episodic, which I don't know how you can have seven main characters and an antagonist and auxiliary antagonists without it feeling like there's a lot of masters to be served. That just comes with a fucking territory. Then there's the group who feels that this is just chock full of jump scares and that disqualifies it as a good movie. And those people don't know how movies work. They do understand that The Shining has jump scares, right? That there's sequences in there where you're scared just because the music tells you it's scary. That's how horror movies work, people.
I will say that I feel like the trailers for this movie ruined almost every jump scare. Almost every single Pennywise jump scare from the trailers just played out like they played in the trailers, and I was pretty disappointed that there were some great moments where Pennywise comes rushing at the screen that I was like, I've seen this like a million times now, like I know exactly what's coming. I felt like the trailers did it a disservice by showing a lot of the cool Pennywise stuff. Not all of it.
Not all that garage sequence is singular.
Yes.
That garage sequence takes everything that may have come in the book and everything that came in the TV miniseries and goes, oh, wait, check this out. And the way Pennywise moves where he can just unfold and refold.
Yeah.
That I felt was just crazy looking. That enjoyed.
I some negative reviews said, oh, they do that. He does that kind of, you know, herky jerky kind of movement, like a lot of, you know, in a lot of modern horror. And I would agree, except I think that it is effective here, because I think that one reason why I felt that this Pennywise worked better than the 1990 Pennywise is he, you know, with a few exceptions, Pennywise in the miniseries just looks like a guy wearing clown makeup.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, in this, he's barely passing for a human, wearing clown makeup and some weird sort of Victorian, you know, pierrot costume. But I mean, he looks like he's barely held together.
Well,
and he's kind of moving like a marionette, and like he doesn't really, like he's uncomfortable trying to move like a human being, and so he's kind of like sort of limping, and you know, like he doesn't have any control over himself as a human.
Well, and as for it being episodic, that's kind of the nature of the beast. I mean, that's the That's the story. The story is very episodic. And when you lose some of the connective tissue of delving into the history of Derry and doing all the cosmic rituals the kids actually have to do in the book, it does become a series of just sort of escalating events until you get to the climax. And I think that the episodic nature of the story gets sort of brushed over and smoothed out in the novel because you're jumping around in time so much that you don't notice that it's very A to B to C. Yeah. But once you just sort of lay it all out in chronological order, you're like, oh, it is kind of a quick and dirty story that culminates in a final battle. And that's just me. That's just that's the story. That's the story of the 1989 or 88 story of it.
When you do an adaptation, you take what works and you leave the rest behind. That's the only way. You can only tell the story that fits the medium in which you're trying to tell it. Could this have worked as an 8-part HBO miniseries or on Netflix or Amazon? Of course it could have. I don't think it would have. You would not have had the experience of viewing it with other people, of having them laugh and getting the charge of a group laugh, or having the charge of group screams, or having people spontaneously clap. That's the only time you get that experience is when you go to a movie theater, when everyone else is in it, and experience something all at the same time. The couple that was next to us got up and left in the middle of the third act.
Oh.
She could not take it.
She was scared?
I've had enough. I can't. I told you I couldn't do it, and I can't. And she got up and left.
Oh, no.
To his credit, he got up and went with her, but she was unnerved. So
yeah, they're gonna have a long, unpleasant conversation on the way home. Yeah.
And she could have been triggered by any number of things in this movie because it's all about how you are vulnerable as a child and there's all these levels of machinations that are going on around you that you cannot control. And as a result, like, without that group experience, I just don't think it's... There are very few times when we all get to do that, and it might be dwindling. It might be going away. So while it could have functioned for the characters better in some other medium, I do feel that it is worthy of what it ended up being. And, you know, some people are not very good at understanding that. Let's talk about one of them. We're all familiar with this individual. He goes by the name of Lights Camber Jackson.
Oh, Mr. Camber Jackson didn't like the movie.
Mr. Camber Jackson didn't like this movie. The other thing is, I don't know that Mr. Camber Jackson watched the movie. This is something I pick up occasionally from his reviews.
Who was it that, what was the movie that Rex Reed, he claimed to have watched and didn't actually watch it?
I don't remember what it was, but I do know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and he clearly did. He got like 20 minutes and like, yeah, you have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, and that's the vibe. I think let me read you one thing here, okay? It's just, I don't want to bag on this individual any more than he needs it, but for Christ's sakes.
But he really needs it.
He does. It is the latest highly anticipated adaptation of a very popular Stephen King novel. That's his opening sentence.
Well, that's true. Okay. I'm with you. I mean, so far.
He's not
wrong.
He's not very fact. Doesn't really draw you in.
Right.
Again, when you're going to write film reviews, writing is a component of this. Okay. Though, much like this year's Get Out, it isn't really a horror film. And that's when I go, you don't know what you're talking about. And that's okay. You should be allowed to not know everything in this world. But if you're going to call yourself Lights, Camera, Jackson, the things that happen after the result of the lights and the camera, you should have some understanding of. And even if I go back to being a classicist about film theory and say, what is a horror film? Okay, a horror film involves the macabre and some sense of the supernatural. This fits into a horror film. Newsflash, so does Get Out. But this, all he's trying to do is just like put this in this other category where he can be against the grain, where he can stand up against the wave of other people being okay or positive towards this and go, see, my taste is above all this. And at the end of it, you're like, you don't know what the fucking movie's about. He ends this endless sentence with, instead, what it is, fucking stop with the ellipsis. What it is a creepy tale of a small town and an angry clown. Just close your fucking computer. And seriously, read some books. Read some Roger Ebert reviews. Listen to some Pauline Kael interviews. For Christ's sake, pick up Truffaut's Conversations with Hitchcock. For the love of God, learn some fucking film theory, please. If you're going to be the next generation of Rex Reed, guess what? We don't need it. I'm probably going to cut all of this out, but I had to fucking say it.
No, please don't. This is great. Because I'm usually the one that goes on these, like, you know, furious blood pressure raising rants, and it's about time that I spread the wealth a little bit and let you go on one. But I mean, but honestly, is there anything worse than a contrarian? I mean, really, is there any I'm pretty sure, you know, particularly since the age of the internet has become upon us, that they're going to have to do a newly revised edition of Dante's Inferno and create a whole new level for contrarians, because there's nothing more insufferable and unnecessary than somebody going in and taking something that is getting a lot of positive reviews, getting a lot of, you know, people really excited about it, and say, yeah, you know what, that wasn't that good.
I mean, well, there's more, just, mainly that you're dumb for liking it.
Yeah, there's nothing worse. There's nothing worse.
Now, I can understand why people wouldn't like this movie. Like, I can legitimately see why people will go in and go, this ain't for me. I can even see why people will go in and say, this isn't scary. Because, well, first of all, I didn't find it that scary, but I did find it very atmospheric and effective. It kept me instilled me with a sense of dread throughout the whole thing. But I do feel that as far as horror goes, this is horror with like a very strong, and this is very typical of Stephen King, horror with an extremely strong moral center. This is about good versus evil. This is about, you know, there are things that are bad in this world and there are people who are good in this world. And like, this is not a debauch. It's very much a movie about kids trying to set things right in a very bad world. And so I don't even think you can come at this movie with just like it's a excessive horror film. Like, it makes its point, and it has its heart set in a very like black and white good versus evil world.
Yeah, I'm not even sure how you could look at it and say, no, this isn't a horror movie. I mean, it's got blood exploding out of a sink. It's got, you know, a child dragged into a sewer to his doom, and I'm not sure, like, okay, if it's not horror, then what is it?
Yes, these kids are seeing their mortality right in front of them, and their brothers are dying. They see all these kids around them disappearing. They feel like they are circling a drain, and at the bottom of that drain is a very hungry mouth. Listen, something's either funny to you or it isn't. It's involuntary. You either laugh or you don't. Something's either scary to you or not. You either jump or you don't. And if you come back to me and say, these are the reasons why I feel this doesn't work, and I did not buy this component of it does not play for me, and as a result, the structure breaks down, and while I feel this works and that doesn't, this, like, okay, you understand how film works. You're coming at me with an opinion that is informed. But when you just go, you're dumb for believing this, for thinking this clown scary, you're like, oh, I don't, that's not movie criticism, man.
It's not. And it's not a criticism. It's a. You're not criticizing the movie. You're criticizing the people that enjoyed the movie.
Yeah.
And again, that's not. We don't. You can keep that. Nobody really needs that. You know, nobody needs to have their bubble of enjoyment burst because someone is bored and lonely and doesn't have any friends off the internet.
Well, and I can also say that this story in particular, this might be one of those stories that just means more to a person the older you get, because I mean, I'm not saying that young people wouldn't appreciate it, but it is one of those things, especially with a lot of Stephen King. The older you get and the more you look back on childhood and the more perspective you get on your own childhood, especially with it, like it's the quote. It's the, you know, being a child is, what is it? Being a child is learning how to live and being an adult is learning how to die. And that's sort of exemplified in this story. And the more perspective you get on childhood and adulthood, the more terrifying these kind of tales are. The more aware of your own mortality you become, the more horrifying these types of stories become. So a person who looks at a story like this and says, this isn't scary, this isn't horror, might have a different opinion on that in 10 years, in 15 years, in 20 years.
That's one of the things that King does so well, is if you read these books at different times of your life, it changes. Like I mentioned earlier about how I didn't get until I was much older that much of what The Shining was actually about was alcoholism. You know, I first read Pet Sematary when it initially came out, which I guess I was maybe about 11 or 12. And then I tried rereading it after I became a parent, which I do not under any circumstances recommend.
Yeah, it's a rough one.
Because you find yourself, when you read initially, you find what Lewis Creed does after his son passes away as horrifying. And then when you're a parent, you're like, yeah, you know, I don't think that's such a weird idea, you know. And
yeah.
I could definitely see myself probably breaking down and doing that, because it's just the idea of what losing a child is like, even just, you know, entertaining the idea until you are a parent, and it just takes on a whole new dimension.
Yeah.
And that being said, there were a slew of young people at my screening, entire gaggle of teenagers who whooped and hollered and had these huge reactions to everything that happened. They were buying it.
I have a two-part question for the both of you.
All right, sure.
Now, obviously, one, you know, glaring scene that we're not going to talk about in the book was thankfully left out.
Yeah, of course.
What do you, and I thought it funny that how they did sort of play that scene was how I thought it should have been done in the book, and how I and to this day it boggles me as to why they didn't just do that. But what were you disappointed that was left out of this? Is the first part of the question. What were you disappointed by? What was left out of this one? And what do you hope they will leave in the, other than the cosmic turtle? Like, what little scenes and memorable moments in the second half do you hope that they leave in?
What I missed from this that I wish had been there is if they had let Mike be the historian and let Ben be the kid whose father had died in the war, and his desire to see him back is something that he's tempted by Pennywise.
Yeah.
But in a 1988 setting, what war would his
exactly
father have died in?
And that's the problem. Is how, where could he possibly have this happened? And
they,
I was
could've,
like,
they could've
that's
changed.
Where I became stymied was like, I just think that's one of the things, by the circumstances of how you're going to work it, you're going to have to sacrifice that part. And I just wish they had found another way to shuffle it. Maybe he hadn't died in military service.
Yeah, he could have been a cop, or
he could have been a cop.
He could have died in an accident or something.
Exactly. So, some sort of loss. Where the reason why he's there is this, and he feels like if Dad were here, I wouldn't be in this situation, would have been something that would have felt particularly resonant. That's what I'm going for. It would have felt resonant with the audience, new and old. What I would like for there to be in the next scene is I really want that Stan Urie scene to be as powerful as it is in both the book and the miniseries. And they set it up well, but I still think it's going to be something where how do you get that dread back where you see him, you understand the reason why he's going to crumble right then and there. Do you do that? Do you have him slit his wrists in the bathtub? Do you have him show back up and immediately just put a gun to his head? Like, how do
we
play this?
Oh, God, no, I hope they don't do that. I mean, I hope that they are, you know, immediately established as weakened by just finding out that he pretty much almost immediately committed suicide as soon as he was told what was going on. Yeah, that right there is just like, oh, well, this isn't a good start.
Yeah,
because they needed the Quartet of Seven in order to do this, which makes much more sense in the book than the words I just said.
Yeah.
But in Stephen King lore, you need a group for the most part to get shit done, and there's a distinct reason for it. The reason they survive in the end is all seven of them are there. They survive for the same reason they survived that rock fight, because they back each other up.
Yeah. Well, beyond what I said before about the cosmological, the cosmic stuff, the Lovecraftian stuff, besides all that, what I miss from the book that I wish had been in the first movie is, there's a lot, and I feel like it's unfair. I wish we'd gotten to see what happened to the rest of the bullies.
Should we assume that Henry killed them?
We don't know because they sort of dropped those characters immediately, and I hope since we didn't see Henry's body hit the ground, I'm going to assume they can still bring him back for the second movie. We never see him be dead, so but I wish we had gotten to see more of, because you know the clown's not it is not going to kill those kids, the main kids. Part of the joy was seeing the joy, but part of the creepiness of the book was the way the different bullies all got knocked off, that fed into their like hidden lives and hidden predilections and hidden terrors. And we just didn't get to see that. We got to see like one bully get killed by something that scared him, and I feel like that was part of the meat of the original. I also wish we gotten to see more of the history of Derry and learned a little bit more about it, but I just love that stuff. For the second movie, I really, really hope that they go off in a different direction. This isn't a specific thing, but I would love for it to be just full of surprises. As far as like, you know, maybe even as far as like who dies, who commits suicide in the beginning, maybe it's a different character in this one. Maybe it doesn't even happen. Maybe they just veer off in a completely different way of getting back to Derry. Like, we don't know, because I have to believe that there's a master plan behind this sequel, that they had to have been writing towards this sequel. Because like they tried to present the announcement of there's going to be a second It as some kind of big surprise. But we know that that's been in the drawing board for the entire time. The only real wish that I have, and this is just a reflection of modern horror in general, is that I really hope Patrick Wilson isn't one of the kids.
Why?
Oh, what do you from your lips to God's ears.
I love Patrick
because
Wilson.
Because he's in every
horror film these days. And
oh,
I am,
okay. Fair
and
enough.
I am just like, I can see them being like, he'd make a great Bill. He'd make a great Bill. Patrick Wilson would really make a great Bill. And I'm like,
number one on the fucking call sheet and is going to be Patrick fucking Wilson.
And I'm like, this
Warner Brothers loves him. You know.
And
they are itching to put him in there. And I beg them from the bottom of my soul, just don't, because it's too expected. You already gave us a whole bunch of people that you didn't expect, you know, that this movie works. You don't need to game it to get people to come
back.
Well,
my big wish when this was announced was that all the surviving children from the original miniseries would play the older versions of their characters in the second movie, the new, because they're all the right age, so they can just get. But I mean, unfortunately, you know, like young, you know, the actor who played Bill is dead, but everyone else I think is still alive. So just throw them into those roles. That'd be a great, as they say, Easter egg for the fans. And it would give Emily Perkins work again, because she's one of my favorite horror actors.
Okay, mine are just kind of standalone scenes. Even though this is complete wish listing, because I know there's no possible way it would have come across on film well, but the one scene to my dying day that I will remember from it that it will never leave my mind ever is the death of Patrick Hockstetter. Who is basically like sucked dry by something that I pictured in my mind as being like a, you know, those stuffed shell noodles? Looking like that with wings. But, you know, it's such a, because it's so hard to imagine what this looks like that it actually makes it scarier. He gets these little creatures attaching themselves to him, and then, you know, and then he gets dragged into an abandoned refrigerator. And of course, in this one, Patrick Hockstetter is the bully who he just like dragged away by something. He kind of looks like Adam Driver a little bit, which is
kind of look like Adam Driver.
Very satisfying.
And then I think in the second one, another standout scene that really shook me up was when. Sorry, that's my cat in the background. is when Beverly goes home to visit her father, and there's a whole extended sequence in which an old lady is living at her house.
Yeah.
And then the house basically turns to candy, and then it's just this really spooky scene. You know, apparently I think that her father has actually died at some point, and that it's Pennywise who is disguising himself as this old lady. And again, I think that might be a little hard to. I mean, they kind of did it okay in the miniseries. I think they did away with the candy house aspect.
Yeah, they did.
But they, you know, the old lady kind of looked like her face was melting, and that was pretty rad. And you know, I think that it could be done fairly well. But that's just, you know, that's a particular scene that I would like to see. Did either of you think that they were going to actually have the Paul Bunyan statue come to life?
Oh, I thought it for like half a second. As soon as I saw the statue, I'm like. That thing's not going to start walking around.
Yeah, there were definitely like little touches of, you know, yep, we read the book. Here's Kneebolt Street. Yeah. Here's Witcham Street. You know, I
mean, that was kind of cool to see the streets. Yeah.
Yep. I was like, I remember. It's like all triggered. Like, yeah, I remember that part. You know, I mean, it's just. But I mean, again, I think that having the Paul Bunyan statue come to life works a lot better in a book than actually seeing it happen.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with the hedge mazes in The Shining.
Right.
Right.
Like having the hedge animals works in your it works in your mind.
And
but
oh God,
once you see it
so,
roaming around, you're like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever
seen.
It was
so bad in the miniseries. It was just such a ridiculous thing.
Well, the hedge maze worked for me in the book because they explicitly say that you never see the animals move. Like they only move when you're not looking at them and you just hear something and then you turn and they're all frozen behind you. And then I was like, why'd they have to CGI them into moving animals in the TV? Like, that's the easiest effect. You just
don't show them
move.
Because they could. I mean,
no, they couldn't.
Well, they thought they could. You know.
In theory, they could.
They succeeded with the hedge animals as well as they succeeded at making Steven Weber frightening.
Oh, Steven Weber. Steven Weber works very well in a good many things. He's the best thing about the Desperation miniseries.
Oh, wow, you're right.
And he's also a fantastic voice actor in his audiobook version of it.
Oh, yeah.
He's great in. So,
no, this is not me slagging on Steven Weber. This was
yes,
me.
Yes, you are.
This was me slagging.
You're taking Steven Weber to task. You're Mr. Anti-Steven Weber.
Bronson Pinchot's the best part of the.
Oh, Jesus. Can we do a bonus episode at some point on the Langoliers? Because I have things to say.
I don't know that there's enough room on the internet for what we would have to say about the Langoliers. It's talk about a one joke story from Stephen King that goes on too long. Holy hell. All right. Well, listen, we could talk about this all day, and we almost did.
Yes.
But when it comes down to it, we all urge you to go out and see it. And see it in the theater with people around you.
Mm-hmm.
And put your phone down if that's something you really need to hold on to. A couple days ago, someone got on Twitter and decided to make a proclamation that the way to get people to come back to movie theaters is to allow people to text. And this is the best argument ever against that.
I saw at the Alamo, it was a full house. I don't think anybody really cared about not being able to use their cell phones.
No, this is something you need to be. You need to be around and experience en masse. Mm-hmm. And then, yes, you can witness the details more intimately for the rest of your life in the confines of your own home. But go out and see a movie. And I understand if you can't. Like, babysitters are expensive. Getting popcorn and candy ain't cheap. But
get a movie pass.
Get a movie
pass. Yeah. especially horror movies. The things that don't work very well on your laptop screen, you usually just need to be seeing them with other people.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's mass hypnosis.
Yeah.
And it only works if you're part of the group, is what it comes down to. And with that, thank you ever so much, Phil. Where can people hear more from you?
Well, I have a podcast called It's Del Toro Time that I do with my 16-year-old Ollie, where we've gone through the movies of Guillermo del Toro, and now we're going through and his friends, and now we're going through all the movies that inspired him. You can find it at deltorotime.wordpress.com or just search It's Del Toro Time.
And with The Shape of Water coming soon.
Yeah, we got a big one.
This is the perfect time to jump on board, because I think people are going to be talking about Shape of Water, from what it sounds like, here towards the end of the year. It seems to be getting a great response.
Yeah, it's building a lot of steam.
I cannot wait.
Gina, where can people find out more about you on the internet?
Well, not necessarily so much about me, but they can find out my thoughts on 70s and 80s television at tuneintonight.wordpress.com.
Reach out to us on Twitter at KillByKillPod. Have something longer to say, more than 140 characters. KillByKillPod@gmail.com. KillByKillPodcast on Instagram. Rate and review us on iTunes if you got a second. If you like the show, it helps us be seen and heard by more people. And if you tell us what your favorite kill is in the Friday the 13th series, or even it, we'll talk about it here on the air. That's our solemn promise to you, the Kill by Kill listener. And so don't fret, people. A new episode of concerning the Friday the 13th series is forthcoming. We're not getting in the way of that at all. The body count continues. We'll see you later, people. Bye bye.
You'll float too.
Woo! Kill by Kill is produced by We Write Good and is intended for entertainment purposes only. Friday the 13th is owned by Paramount Pictures. Jason is owned by New Line Cinema. No infringement is intended. Kill by Kill logo was designed by Josh Hollis. Visit him at joshhollis.com. The Kill by Kill theme was created exclusively for us by Revenge Body. Get the whole track and much, much more at revengebodymemphis.bandcamp.com today.